Service. Ethics. Advocacy. Welcome to the AICPA Tax Section Podcast. The Tax Center provides guidance, information, and tax practice tools to support the three goals of the AICPA Tax Section Strategic Plan: practice support, professional standards and ethics, and Washington representation. The AICPA Tax Section Podcast is one more source of information on all things tax and tax-related. In this episode, William Stromson, Director of the AICPA Tax Division, will discuss current developments in tax law and practice.
Hello, this is Bill Stromson, a director with the AICPA Tax Team in Washington, D.C., and this is the Tax Section Audio E-Alert for February 20th, 2009. This is part of our new bi-weekly series of podcasts to report tax law and tax practice developments to CPAs. These are based on emailed alerts that tax section members receive and that include hot links to the source materials that we refer to in this audio version. Please consider joining the AICPA Tax Section to take full advantage of our practice alerts. You can join online at aicpa.org/tax. Today I'm covering two topics: the latest on coping with the Section 7216 penalty regulations on the unauthorized disclosure of tax return information, and the new Stimulus Act, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, that was signed into law this week. Let's start with Section 7216. As I reported earlier, the regulations went into effect on January 1st, just in time for this tax season. Code Section 7216 was written to protect taxpayer privacy, and it prohibits the unauthorized disclosure of tax return information by return preparers. Its terms were written and have always been interpreted broadly to protect taxpayers, and it carries potential criminal penalties for return preparers. Maintaining client confidences is at the core of our profession, and in general, we haven't had any trouble with Section 7216. However, the broad language and potential penalties have caused concern for some CPAs, with definitions of tax return information and disclosure seeming to encompass a variety of routine and harmless practices. To help clarify the application of the regulations, we've met with IRS officials and want to bring you the latest information that we have. We think it's highly unlikely that you'll incur a penalty, let alone a criminal penalty, but you have to pay attention to these important regulations. For purposes of the revised Section 7216 regulations, CPAs should understand that, in general, they will not need to obtain written consents from their clients in the normal course of providing tax return preparation services and any related tax planning or accounting services. An informed and thoughtful implementation of these confidentiality rules is important, however, so the AICPA has provided some practice guidance for our members on the resources page of our website, under the Tax Practice Guides and Checklist bullet. This resource information includes consent forms and additional analysis of the regulations. Many AICPA members are understandably concerned about areas of the regulations that appear to be unclear as to when Section 7216 consents must be obtained. The AICPA is in active contact with the IRS about these issues and is seeking further guidance to clarify such matters. While we're committed to this dialogue with the service, we feel it is important to point out those areas of practice for preparers where we believe the regulations are clear and written consent is not required. Thus, as a general matter, a preparer does not need to obtain a Section 7216 waiver when, and here's a whole series of items for you, when you're providing tax return preparation services and any related tax planning or accounting services, and discussing such services with the client, so long as the preparer does not expect to share tax return information with a third party or another preparer, whether or not within the same firm located outside the United States. So you have to be careful using outsourcing. Mailing a newsletter directly from the preparer's office shouldn't be a problem, so long as it focuses only on tax return preparation and related tax planning or accounting matters. The issue here is whether you provide an outside contract mailer with client addresses and information in order to enable them to mail the newsletter to the client. And this could be construed as disclosing to a third party, the outside contractor, the tax return information, the taxpayer's address. Another area you don't have to get a disclosure consent for is utilizing a second preparer to perform auxiliary services related to processing of the tax return, services that generally involve the mechanical processing of the return. This would be a return preparation service, a software, transmittal of a return electronically in an e-file operation. Another one you don't have to worry about: updating the accounting firm's tax preparation software, or when disclosing return information in connection with the programming, maintenance, repair, testing, or procurement of equipment or software used in tax return preparation. And here's another: disclosing or using tax return information to the IRS, state, or local authorities for purposes of return preparation or handling an audit. If you process collection fees for services, if you're having your services processed for collection, this is not, does not require disclosure authorization. Maintaining your client's records, including copies of returns, also doesn't need any disclosure authorization. We're working with the IRS to get some additional guidance on many of the issues we've become aware of. And without their guidance, we can't be sure that the thoughts below are technically accurate, but they appear to be reasonable interpretation, so here goes. If a client does not respond to a request for consent, you should be able to send additional requests or call the client to encourage them to complete the form. It's only when the client, quote, declines a request for consent, quote, that you are prohibited from making further attempts to obtain approval. However, Treasury regulations under 7216 suggest that the preparer may make requests for consent involving subsequent year tax returns. Here's another we think is within the ballpark of being a reasonable interpretation. Although written consent must be a document separate from the engagement letter, it can be included in the same envelope. And another, until we receive further clarification from the IRS, it seems prudent to avoid articles and newsletters that offer or solicit services beyond normal tax services. Another thing we think will work is you can get an approval that's effective for multiple years if you specify that in the written consent form. As we get additional information, we'll pass it along, and we're all trying to cope with this new penalty regulation details. Now let's turn over to the new Tax Act. On February 17th, President Obama signed the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009 into law to help stimulate the economy and get us out of a recession. Here are some highlights of the ARRA of 2009. Let's start in the individual area. A new Making Work Pay credit will provide up to $400 for singles or $800 for married couples filing jointly. The credit is 6.2% of earned income and phases out at AGI of $75,000 for singles and $150,000 for married filing jointly. This year, taxpayers won't receive a check like they did for last year's stimulus payment. This year, the credit will be received through a reduction in employee withholding and required estimated tax payments by self-employed individuals. The IRS will send out withholding tables and information to taxpayers. We have another payment, an economic recovery payment of $250 that will be sent to recipients of Social Security, SSI, Railroad Retirement, and Veterans Disability Compensation benefits. But for those who make it, who work, it will offset any of the, it'll be offset by the Make Work Pay credit. The time of the payment and how the IRS is going to coordinate the economic recovery payment with the Making Work Pay credit have not yet been announced. Federal and state pensioners who are not eligible for Social Security benefits will also receive this one-time refundable tax credit. It is also reduced to the extent of any allowable Making Work Pay credit. There's a nice benefit in here for first-time home buyers. It's expanding and improving on last year's version. The new credit is increased to $8,000 for purchases between January 1, 2009 and December 31st, 2009. Despite what was proposed as legislation when Congress was talking about it, the final legislation continues to limit the home buyer's credit to first-time buyers. First-time buyers, by the way, doesn't mean you can't have owned a home before. You just can't have owned a home within the last 3 years before the purchase. The most significant change made by the legislation to this credit is that it does not have to be repaid. Remember, last year there was a credit, but you had to repay it over a period of time. And for those who purchased before January 1, 2009, they have to go with the old interest-free loan credit. And this has caused some grumbling by those who responded to last year's program and now have to repay what others who buy this year will get to keep. The credit applies where the home is occupied as the buyer's principal residence within 24 months of purchase. That's to allow some construction time or relocation time. The credit phases out for taxpayers with AGI in excess of $75,000 for individuals or $150,000 for joint return couples. The credit is refundable, so you can get a refund even if you don't owe tax based on this credit. But it's recaptured if the home is sold within 36 months of the purchase date. A buyer who purchases a home after January 1, 2009 under the new rules can claim the credit on the 2008 return due this April, and that'll help speed receipt of the credit money. There's another nice benefit in here for people who are purchasing a vehicle to help stimulate the auto industry. There's a sales tax deduction for on tax on vehicle purchases that is deductible towards AGI, and thus would be available to people who don't itemize and take a standard deduction. So this is an additional benefit for almost all. The legislation allows a deduction for state, local, and excise taxes paid on purchase of a new car or a light truck. The deduction phases out at levels of $125,000 for singles and $250,000 for married filing jointly. It's interesting to note the varying phase-out levels. In the case of cars, the government is helping to stimulate sales even if moderately higher income individuals benefit. AMT relief is extended through 2009. The legislation increases the AMT exemptions for 2009 to $46,700 for individuals and $70,950 for joint filers. Also, beginning in 2009, an individual may offset the entire regular tax liability or AMT tax liability by the refundable personal credits. There's a new benefit for those with kids in college. It's the American Opportunity Education Tax Credit that replaces the old HOPE Scholarship Credit. This new credit is allowed for up to 4 years of undergraduate education, and for 2009 and 2010, the maximum amount will be $2,500 in each year, and 40% of the credit is refundable. The credit phases out at income levels, AGI income levels of between $80,000 and $90,000 for singles and $160,000 and $180,000 for married filing jointly. So the new credit is really an improvement on the HOPE Scholarship Credit. It's greater in amount, it phases out at higher levels, and it's for 4 years instead of just two. Still, for those who are paying the ever-increasing expenses of college education for their kids, the series of tax breaks we have must still seem like band-aids on a gushing financial artery. A student purchase of a computer can be treated as a qualified education expense for Section 529 plans in 2009 and 2010. This includes software and peripheral equipment. Big audio speakers for iTunes? Not likely. The earned income credit will be increased and more available for low-income families in 2009 and 2010. For families with three or more children, the credit is 45% of the family's first $12,570 of earned income, and the credit phase-out begins $1,880 higher at a level of $21,420. Also for those in lower income levels, the child tax credit refundability is increased in 2009 and 2010. For 2008, the child tax credit was refundable to the extent of 15% of the taxpayer's earned income in excess of $8,500. The new legislation reduces this to $3,000 for 2009 and 2010. There's an interesting assistance here for people who have lost their jobs and now are on COBRA for their health insurance. The federal government will subsidize 65% of COBRA payments for employees who were involuntarily terminated between September 1, 2008 and December 31, 2009. The new provision will become effective March 1, 2009. They haven't really defined involuntary termination specifically, but I think we'll know it when we see it. The subsidy phases out between $125,000 and $145,000 for singles and between $250,000 and $290,000 for married filing jointly. Plan sponsors, including union trust funds and for-profit, tax-exempt, church, and governmental employers, will be responsible for quickly administering the new provisions and will need to work closely with their COBRA administrators to ensure compliance. Mechanically, the former employer will pay 65% of the premiums and then take a payroll tax credit for that amount. Who gets the bill? How does the employer know when the benefit is phased out for the recipient, etc.? There's some big problems in implementation here that need to be clarified quickly. Health coverage tax credit. Effective May 1, 2009, the health coverage tax credit is increased from 65 to 80% of the individual's premiums for qualified health insurance for specific family members. The increased credit expires in 2011. Executive pay restrictions. As you've seen in the news, the Act further restricts executive pay from those financial institutions accepting TARP, that's Troubled Asset Relief Program funds, and provides more checks and balances regarding executive compensation. Now let's change over to some of the tax benefits for businesses. The AARA extends several business tax provisions enacted in the stimulus legislation of 2008, and here are some of the big ones. The 50% bonus depreciation is extended for expenditures made in 2009 and for longer-lived assets in 2010. The Section 168K4 election to accelerate AMT and R&D credits is extended. Last year's stimulus legislation allowed businesses to elect to accelerate the recognition of AMT or R&D credits in lieu of bonus depreciation. This election is now extended until January 1, 2009. The amount that may be accelerated is based on the amount that each taxpayer invests in property that would otherwise qualify for bonus depreciation. The amount is capped at the lesser of 6% of historic AMT and R&D credits, or $30 million. Small business expensing rules are extended. In the 2008 stimulus legislation, Congress increased the expensing provisions for small businesses to $250,000 for assets placed in service in 2008 and phased out the limitations for businesses that purchased more than $800,000 in assets. This rule is extended through 2009. The ARRA also includes a variety of other tax benefits, and here are some of those. The NOL carryback period is extended to 5 years instead of two, but it's only for businesses with $15 million or less in revenues, and it begins with 2008 NOLs, NOLs that were generated in 2008. By the way, some of the larger companies and their advisors had assumed that this benefit would not be limited, and they had already spent time and billable hours preparing carryback claims. So they're a little disappointed at the cap. But this is one of those things where they have to balance the budget, and they're already pretty deep in the hole. For those who qualify for the carryback election, and they've made an election, they've previously made the election to carry back on the old rules, they can change that if they do it on a timely basis, and the IRS is going to provide guidance on how to do that. There's some temporary relief, temporary estimated tax relief for small businesses in the bill. For a tax year that begins in 2009, if an individual has adjusted gross income below $500,000 and more than 50% of that income comes from a small business, the individual will not incur an underpayment of estimated tax penalty if the payments are equal to at least 90% of the tax liability for the year. For this provision, a small business is defined as a business with fewer than 500 employees. Small business stock capital gains. An individual who invests in small business stock and holds the investment for at least 5 years may exclude up to 75% of the gain realized on the disposition of that stock, provided that certain requirements are met. This provision is effective for investments made after the date of enactment and before January 1, 2011. For this purpose, a small business is defined as a corporation with less than $50 million in gross assets. The holding period to avoid the Subchapter S corporation built-in gains tax is temporarily reduced from 10 to 7 years. Prior to enactment of the new legislation, a C corporation converting to an S corporation status had to hold assets for at least 10 years to avoid the tax on any built-in gains in the assets. The legislation reduces the threshold to 7 years, but only for sales occurring in 2009 and 2010. The Enhanced Work Opportunity Credit provides some additional categories of out-of-work individuals who the employer can qualify for the Work Opportunity Credit. It now includes unemployed veterans and disconnected youth. There are specific eligibility criteria for each. This credit is available in 2009 and 2010, and for any employee who started work after December 31st, 2008. The Act provides delayed recognition of certain cancellation of indebtedness income. Under current law, taxpayer generally has income where the taxpayer cancels or repurchases its debt for an amount less than its adjusted issue price. The amount of cancellation of indebtedness income is the excess of the old debt's adjusted issue price over the repurchase price. Certain businesses will be allowed to recognize this cancellation of indebtedness income over 10 years. That allows them to defer tax on the cancellation for the first 4 or 5 years and recognize this income ratably over the following 5 years. This is for specified types of businesses that repurchased debt after December 31st, 2008 and before 2011. This may provide an opportunity for a debt issuer to buy back obligations at the current discounted levels and delay recognition of the cancellation of indebtedness income. If you'd like more information on the new tax bill, the AICPA has held a webcast on the bill and its archived so you can listen in on it. If you want CPE for listening, there's a small charge. Also, the AICPA is preparing a self-study course on the new tax law, and you'll be able to order that shortly through at the CPA to Biz website. Well, thanks for listening, and we at the AICPA Tax Section hope you're having a profitable tax season. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AICPA Tax Section Podcast. Join the Tax Section and receive emailed alerts with links to many of the source documents referenced in this podcast. And be sure to tune in next time for even more coverage of all things tax and tax related.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered and does not represent an official opinion or position of the AICPA. It is provided with the understanding that the AICPA is not engaged in rendering legal, accounting, or other professional services. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The AICPA makes no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assumes no responsibility for, the content or application of the material contained herein, and expressly disclaims all liability for such damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.